Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a forensic conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Forensic as in forensic toxicology. Forensic is often key in crime investigation. I love the popular series Forensic Files, especially the medical episodes. In the series, the forensics is the star of the show. I was sent a piece of forensics the other day, the autopsy report of famous Friends star Matthew Perry. The death certificate cause of death was acute effects of ketamine. And other contributing factors related to immediate cause of death were drowning, coronary artery disease, buprenorphine effect. The manner of death was listed as accident. I was interested in the drug testing part of the report. The Los Angeles Medical Examiner's Office took toxicology samples from the heart, femoral blood, gastric contents, liver, urine, and eye. Forensic toxicology showed ketamine at levels of 3,540 nanograms per milliliter in the peripheral blood and 3,271 nanograms per milliliter in the central blood. For context, the ME, the medical examiner report, included that general anesthesia levels are between 1,000 to 6,000 nanograms per milliliter. The ME detected buprenorphine in therapeutic levels, and they found non-toxic levels of lorazepam, an anxiety medication. And there was no alcohol, methamphetamine, cocaine, heroin, PCP, or fentanyl. The medical examiner explains that buprenorphine was added as a contributing cause of death because of the additive respiratory effects when present with high levels of ketamine. How ketamine was administered or where it came from remained a mystery. No source for ketamine was found at the scene. The report was 29 pages, 9 of which included toxicology reports. I reviewed the report multiple times and found all sorts of testing, but I could not find any testing for THC. There's an unproven falsity, even among some medical examiners, that no one dies of marijuana. But if you don't test, you'll never know. There is robust literature showing THC is associated with heart disease, and there's no question that THC has an additive effect with other drugs. Interestingly, that buprenorphine received a contributory mention in death, but lorazepam, also an additive drug, got a pass, and the THC, well, no one even looked for that. Matthew Perry's ketamine drug dealer, in this case, got away with murder. To learn more about forensic toxicology, I reach out to Dr. Michelle Peace. Dr. Michelle Peace is a forensic toxicologist and chair of the Department of Forensic Science at Virginia Commonwealth University. She's a past president of the Society of Forensic Toxicologists and is a member of the International Association of Forensic Toxicologists. She is an international expert in drug testing and holds 3 patents with Procter & Gamble. Her expertise is sought after by the FDA, the National Drug Testing Advisory Board under SAMHSA, and now, also to add to her list, High Truths and Drugs and Addiction. To learn more about Dr. Michelle Peace, check out the High Truth show notes. Dr. Michelle Peace, welcome to High Truths.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm very excited to have you. I want to learn all about toxicology. I saw your presentation with SAMHSA's Drug Testing Advisory Board, a very prestigious national organization, and you talked about cannabinoids, semi-synthetic cannabinoids, and I wanted to say, oh, I have to have her on my podcast. So as we start, I thought what we would do is get a little background about you and what is a forensic toxicologist. Talk about drug testing, e-cigarettes, THC, CBD, and Delta products. And we can, you know, hopefully get to cover all that.
Okay.
So let's start with you. You are a forensic toxicologist. What is that and why did you decide to become one?
Well, that's a great question. And I'm going to break it down into its components. And let's talk about what a toxicologist is first. A toxicologist is somebody who evaluates tissues. Those are body fluids or other kinds of tissues from a body to determine what kinds of drugs or poisons or chemicals, pesticides that person could have consumed or been exposed to. And then when you apply that to the forensic world, then we are assessing, did that drug, poison, chemical actually contribute to its death, to that person's death? Another application of forensics to toxicology is, did that drug or chemical or poison actually lead to some kind of impairment behavior, as we would think in terms of like driving impairment? That also applies to athletics. Was somebody doping so that it would improve their athletic performance? And then probably the third major application of toxicology to forensics is in drug testing, employee drug testing. And that's oftentimes really in the scope of workplace drug testing or what we would call also federal drug testing programs. So, that is the summation of what forensic toxicology is. The reason why I decided I wanted to be a forensic toxicologist was that at the heart of toxicology, you are both a chemist and a biologist. And so I was a chemistry major at Wittenberg University in Springfield, Ohio, and I love chemistry and I love the language of chemistry, but I really wanted a very practical application to it. How can I leverage this? I love thinking about problem solving at this molecular level. And so I really didn't know what to do with that. And while I was in my junior year, I had visited a crime lab. And, it was just a tour. And I thought, wow, this is like the coolest thing. And so the sections that we toured at the crime lab were very biology focused. So I thought when I went back, I thought, wow, I don't have really that much biology. I need to take some biology courses. So as a biologist, right, as a student in a biology course, I thought, wow, this is really all chemistry. So that naturally led me down this path towards toxicology, right? So we are using chemical analyses to apply that to biological specimens, right? So it's analytical chemistry, right? Because I'm using, gas chromatography and liquid chromatography and mass spectrometry to analyze for drugs, poisons, and chemicals. And then I have to know how those drugs, poisons, and chemicals interact with the body. Like, how do they bind to receptors, or how do they interact with cell membranes? And what is that toxicological response? What's an adverse effect going to be if somebody is exposed to a drug or a chemical or a toxin? So it really became a marriage of all of the things that really interested me. And then the forensic piece of it was that I wanted to be able to provide a service, right? My heart really is in serving communities and helping, communities find solutions. So I do a lot of mentoring, for young people, and right where I, like guide them through decisions and what their futures are going to be, or help them with, you know, very difficult decisions. Right. So I've got a servant heart. And so when you're talking about, you know, analyzing chemicals, and understanding how they work in the body, and you also have a servant heart, you want to serve your community, then forensic toxicology was the marriage of all of that.
That's really cool. I like that servant heart. And what's the funnest part? Are you like the NCIS TV show and all the different crime shows? Is that what your life is like? Or
no. So I'm a professor at Virginia Commonwealth University. And so I have a research laboratory, and I do a lot of teaching. And so probably my favorite part of all of that, you know, the science is cool, no doubt about it. I mean, my research team is doing some really, really amazing work. I'm very fortunate to have a great team of student scientists. But I would say that my favorite part is, are the relationships that I build with them, and, you know, being able to advocate not just for them, but also to advocate for, community safety and public health. So what winds up happening is that my favorite part of it is oftentimes the people part of it. Being able to apply science in that sphere, right? Oftentimes in communities where there's can be a misunderstanding about the nature of science and what science can do to dispel mythology and, you know, to really make our lives better. So I work a lot to try to help people understand the science behind certain things so that they can be empowered to make better decisions. So really I'm using science to build a narrative to help people.
Nice. So now I'll want to take your professorship and learn from you about drug testing. And I want to start with like a high-profile celebrity case, which is, I don't know, Matthew Perry from Friends, sadly, died. And his toxicology report said ketamine was a cause of death. Buprenorphine was a contributing factor. I was sent this autopsy report, and there was 9 pages of forensic toxicology testing. And I was really intrigued by the conclusion because he also had lorazepam in his system, but that wasn't listed as contributory. And yet, you know, all these drugs are additive. Like somehow they picked buprenorphine as additive, even though it was therapeutic levels, but they didn't consider the lorazepam. And in that 9 pages of testing, THC was not even considered. And I'm wondering if eliminating certain drugs like THC and CBD, and you just, you know, talked about all these forensic things that can happen with these drugs, what you think of that, if that, you know, is not part of this standard, that medical examiner didn't kind of follow a standard, or they pick and choose which drugs they want to test for. I mean, they checked her PCP and all these other weird drugs, but they didn't, you know, check for a common one.
So I'll be honest, I've not seen the report. So I don't know. So I'm not going to make comment to the report. And what the medical examiner chose to do or chose not to do. Because I've not read the report and I've not spoken to the scientists involved in that case. It is true that if somebody is taking some kind of mix of medications, or recreationally using some medications, or consuming illicit drugs, that there can be some effects that are going to be the cause of all of those, right? All of those effects either going to sum up to make a greater effect. There could be some effects that are going to even compound them. So let's say, for instance, you have two drugs that use the same metabolic pathway, that one of the drugs might be the preferred drug on that pathway, which means that the other drug might build up and cause a longer effect than what somebody might anticipate. So if somebody is taking multiple drugs at the same time and they're not all reported to a physician, right, so they're self-medicating, then it is very possible that there can be an adverse event or an untoward effect, or in Matthew Perry's case, it could have led to his death. So, you know, this is some of the biggest challenges with, people who are on prescribed medication and then also choose to consume other drugs outside of the care of a physician. That can be particularly dangerous for somebody. I've not read Matthew Perry's death certificate and that report, so I really can't make comment on it as to what specifically was decided for him. We are in, I think, culturally a period in which there's not enough education for people to make decisions about what they do consume, right? I hate to use the term, for recreational purposes. There's a general feeling or philosophy that, well, it's natural, so, you know, it can't be harmful. And so I think we really have to educate our communities about if they choose to consume any of these drugs, whether it's THC or ketamine or, or some of these psychedelics that are in mushrooms, that that they have to do so with extreme caution.
Yeah. And drug testing, because we know fentanyl is everywhere as well. But I was, among your colleagues, and I know you're a leader in forensic toxicology, there's been now for many years a push to create standards among drug testing. And again, that's what the Drug Testing Advisory Board does, but also, forensically. And I wonder, now that we have more prevalence of THC and more adverse events of THC, if there's not a standard of at least including that in a qualitative way, if not quantitative way, in drug testing.
So I think generally speaking, not fully knowing what every single protocol is in every single tox lab across the nation, there are, in testing for THC or some of those other cannabinoids, it is really common drug in a lot of, in, I would say, a lot of panels, if not all panels. In the world of drug testing, whether that's urine drug testing or oral fluid drug testing for employment purposes, there are, at least in the federal program, it is tested for, it is evaluated. By measuring the metabolite of THC, the main metabolite of THC, when we're talking about postmortem situations, different laboratories will have different protocols in terms of decisions they make to evaluate what kind of drugs or toxins could be there. And so while we understand that THC is really common, there could have potentially been some evidence that was at the scene that sort of drove the toxicology team or the medical examiner team or the detectives to make decisions about what they wanted to test for. And again, I don't know. I can't make comment on, you know, what was or was not tested for.
Yeah.
And so.
But you would think that it'd be, like you said, part of the standard drug panel. And I know there's a movement, not federally, but in privately, like I've learned some hospitals now for their employees working in the medical profession are specifically took out the THC because too many people were testing positive. And so they said their answer was, we're just not testing.
Yeah.
Which makes you think, do you really want your surgeon?
Yeah. I mean, it's a major, you're right. It's a major concern, right? So this is why at least the federal program is very concerned about, you know, people who are employed in safety sensitive positions. You know, how do you make sure that they are fit for duty? Right. And so this is a significant conversation in terms of, well, you know, THC is legal in so many states and so many people now are using it for medical purposes and in addition to adult use reasons.
And medical so, in quotations.
Yeah. And so how do you then how do you then make sure that somebody is fit for duty? And so this is a really, really complicated thing that, you know, has lots of considerations of how long does the effects of THC last? And how long can you possibly test for it in urine or oral fluid? And is there a gap between that? This is really, really complicated for THC. And I think the folks at SAMHSA are doing a really great job considering all of the things that that factor into understanding how THC works in the body and then making sure that people who are in safety sensitive positions can report to duty and we can have confidence in their performance. These are really, really difficult. Now, in positions that are not safety sensitive, you know, we do see that because THC, the use of cannabinoids has become so prevalent nationwide, and because people are consuming for medical benefit, then, you know, and if it's not a safety sensitive position, then, you know, the question, you know, begs is like, well, do you need to test for it? And I'm not saying, you know, I'm not casting my opinion one way versus the other. But these are really, really difficult conversations to have from not just a scientific perspective, but also from a cultural perspective.
Yeah. And I just have to like push back a little bit on the medical part, sure, because the medical part has been, the word medical has been hijacked by the industry. And
for sure.
What me as an emergency physician called, yeah, medicine, I have to follow standards,
sure,
right? History, vital signs, drug interactions, right, risk-benefit calculations, where the bud tender is not held to any of those standards. And
right,
yet people call it their medicine,
right,
and you know, without the same scrutiny.
Right.
Is there a way, and then you're saying, okay, people think, oh, it's just marijuana, it's innocent, it's healthy, it's natural. But there's all these new products that you are very familiar with, right? These dabs, yeah, and shatters that are like 90% THC. Can you tell, as a forensic toxicologist, if people consume that versus the weak brand? Is there any way to tell or there's not? And there's a famous case now, Bryn Spacer was convicted of involuntary manslaughter after taking two hits of her boyfriend's bong. And the first hit did nothing. And then he did something to it. We don't know what. And he goes, oh, let me make it stronger. And she did. And she went into psychosis, stabbing her boyfriend 108 times, her dog, and then her neck, and had, you know, extreme cannabis induced psychosis from two hits. They tested the bong and her, positive for THC, no other drugs, no bath salts or PCP or anything weird like that. Just pot. But how can you tell potency?
So I think the first thing I'm going to address on that is, like, again, I don't know what the details of that case are. I don't know what lab actually conducted the analyses. So we might not actually know what else was in that paraphernalia, right? Because we don't know, at least I don't know who did the test. So if the lab did not have a panel for all of these synthetic cannabinoids, then we don't know if it had anything else in it. And so that's the first thing I'll say is that without knowing, you know, what the lab did, we may or may not know whether or not it had something else in it. And so we do know that that there have been a lot of case reports across the nation in which somebody has had severe hallucinations, schizophrenia, these mental breaks after they consume these semi-synthetics. But we also know that there are case reports in which, products have been tested, and we know that they didn't contain the semi-synthetics, and that they did contain high concentrations of delta-9 THC, and that precipitated, hallucinations, schizophrenia, other adverse events. So I think, what this really points to is that if we're going to talk about an adverse event, then we do have to make sure that we are analyzing those products so that we can provide a full description as to what that person consumed that led to the adverse event. I think that's the difficult piece right now.
So I think what you're teaching us is that a forensic panel is not the same thing. Like, you were very, your first reaction was scrutiny of the science and the testing. Did they test for these other semi-synthetic cannabinoids? And maybe explain to us what that means. Did the lab in this case really check everything or not? Right. I think that's your.
Yeah, question. I think, and this is not to be critical of the laboratory. Right. It's when I talk about the semi-synthetics, these are compounds like THCO acetate or THCP or HHC, right? All of these.
Wait, explain to us what those are. THC is THC. So explain all the different
things. So these semi-synthetics that we see in the marketplaces now that are sold under this guise or under the umbrella of being hemp derived, they essentially take CBD and or delta-9 THC and subject it to some kind of chemical process. It will precipitate other cannabinoid structures where functional groups will get added or removed from the delta-9 THC so that you get, at the end of the day, a different compound that has the general structural characteristics of delta-9 THC, but there's something different about the molecule.
So they have the backbone of THC, but little pieces of the molecule on the ends have been changed.
Correct. So, and these, depending on what that change is, they've been named accordingly. And so, so those are, there are currently dozens and dozens of these in the marketplace. If you consider the delta-9 THC molecule itself in terms of you know, double bond shifting and what functional groups can change on the molecule, there are potentially hundreds of semi-synthetic cannabinoids that can be manufactured. So first of all, we call them semi-synthetic because they are derived from CBD or Delta-9 THC that are natural, right? Natural from the plant. And then they get chemically altered. So they are semi-synthetic because the starting material is natural. So we, for the most part, do not know what their pharmacological activity is. We don't know necessarily what all, how they all bind to the receptors. We don't know what their metabolites are. We don't know how long they will have an effect. So we don't know very much at all about the pharmacology and the toxicology of all of these compounds. So, you know, from the products that we've analyzed, oftentimes they are mixtures of these compounds, right? Because frankly, the synthetic process you're not just creating one compound, you create a bunch of different compounds. And because there's no regulatory oversight, because the people that are making these compounds aren't really committed to quality assurance, mm-hmm. they'll create a slurry and just put it all into the mixture. So oftentimes what we've shown over and over and over again is that the concentration that is on the label is wrong, is not what we have found. And it's oftentimes contains 4, 5, 6, 10 other cannabinoids than what's on the label. So I think that's dangerous for consumers. You know, in addition to the fact that a lot of these, because they're not necessarily manufactured in clean facilities, they can be high in bacteria or fungus or contain debris like hair. They can contain some residual solvents that were used during the manufacturing process. So, you know, generally speaking, as pretty as the package is, and despite the fact that there's a certificate analysis that comes with it, we have rarely found where the product tested itself actually matched that certificate. So that, again, is dangerous for the consumer.
Right. Tell us about, you were explaining that the backbone of the THC, the Delta 9 is like the position of a molecule. Then there's the Delta 8s, Delta 10s. This is all what you're calling semi-synthetic, correct?
Right.
All right. And those are being sold, you know, legally, although there's now like there's a bill coming out in Florida trying to make those products illegal. You also mentioned THC. O and O8, what are those? Is that the same kind of thing as Delta 9, Delta 10, just a different shifting molecule?
So I'm going to go back and talk about Delta 8, Delta 9, and Delta 10, and 6A, 10A, and right. So is that it's complicated. And this is where the industry has sort of also gotten away with being able to tell their own narrative about it that is untrue. So the challenge is that Delta 8 and Delta 10 are natural cannabinoids from the plant. And they are in very, very low concentrations in the plant. And they might not even exist in some plants. So, but yet they are still considered natural cannabinoids. And the pushback that I have given from a policy perspective and a legislative perspective is that the concentration of these cannabinoids is so high in these products that there's no way that they could have processed enough plant material for that compound to be in that product at that concentration. So just as an example, we had somebody come in with what he thought was a hemp-derived product and it was supposed to have delta 8 in it. And it's supposed to have 45 milligrams of delta 8 in it. Now, delta 8 is natural. It was being sold as a natural product. Okay. So when we tested it, now this gentleman purchased two of these. They were honey sticks. And this gentleman purchased two. And he consumed one of them and had horrific hallucinations for 4 to 5 hours. Like horrifying. Believed his legs had been cut off and were laying on the other side of the room. Couldn't figure out how to dial his phone. You know, believed that he was dying. I mean, this was in no capacity a pleasurable hallucination. He was terrified for 4 to 5 hours. So he found me, you know, because of, if you Google the right things, I'm easy to track down. And so we got the other honey stick. And the other honey stick contained more than 600 milligrams of delta 8, more than 200 milligrams of delta 9, right? So this product was loaded. So if you just do the math, if we're just talking about the delta 8 alone, and we say, all right, let's say that this delta 8 is natural. How much plant material would you have to process to make that single honey stick? So if we give the benefit of the doubt that a plant is 1% delta 8, it was going to take 14 pounds of plant material to make that single honey stick. So in no way is that product natural, right? So it's just not going to happen. So the delta 8, delta 9, delta 10 conversation is complicated because they are natural cannabinoids, but what we're finding in the products is that they're largely synthetic.
Yeah, but practically speaking, if you're buying a delta 8 or 10 product, it's made in a lab. It's not from a plant.
Correct. Yeah. So, but it's being sold as natural.
Right. Well, so, people, they lie.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, this is the point of it, is that the industry is running the narrative on this.
Right.
So when we talk about the other cannabinoids, right, the THCO and the THCP.
And explain to us what that is. What's an O? What's a P?
Yeah. So the O is that an acetate group has been added to the delta 9 THC backbone. And so that gives that backbone different properties, different that have been called it's more spiritual. It's been known to create hallucinations. It's sort of sold as this, you're going to have hallucinations with this. THCP is, and the P indicates that there is an extension of a carbon chain. So the delta 9 THC backbone has a carbon chain on it, a long carbon chain. And so the P indicates that that carbon chain is longer. So that also changes how delta 9 THC interacts with the receptor. So, so it's not just that we are moving double bonds inside of the backbone, but things are getting added to that backbone as well that changes its function in the body.
Wow. And then as far as testing, I know as a physician, if it's delta 9 THC, I could detect it. If it's anything else, if it's CBD or the 8s and the 10s and the O's and the P's, I won't know that. That will not come up in my drug screen. And from what I understand from you, a typical forensic lab, like in, you know, like the Bryn Spacer case, or doesn't test for these other products unless you specifically ask for them. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I think the first thing is to appreciate that there are generally two kinds of drug testing. And one is the federal drug testing that is essentially regulated through the certification program, NLCP, National Laboratory Certification Program, that is the program that comes out of SAMHSA. So that is for federal requirements for safety-sensitive positions. And, you know, they have a very specific list that every single person that gets pulled under that program, they get tested for a very specific panel every single time. And so I think there is conversation about adding some of these other cannabinoids to that panel. When we're talking about other kinds of just regular workplace drug testing, then depending on where that sample ends up, there could be a lab that has added some of those compounds to their panel, Delta 8, CBD, but they will not have added all of them. And so there are some drug testing labs, and there are some postmortem testing labs, toxicology labs, that probably have not expanded their panel to include all of these compounds that exist. So if there is reason to believe that they need to test for that, then they probably have to send that out. They've made a decision that we're going to send that to a lab who can test it. Some labs do that so that they can understand what the full panel is. Now, you know, what is interesting about this and increases the complication in the world of drug testing is that these products that are, you know, the THCOs and the Ps usually have some Delta-9 THC in it, because that manufacturing process is a dirty process in a way, right? It's going to create lots of cannabinoids.
Mm-hmm.
And so oftentimes Delta-9 THC can be found in somebody. If the product they chose to take is really THCO, there's probably Delta-9 THC in there. So that'll probably show up on a drug test. But there's probably going to have to be some kind of indicator that they need to send that sample out for further testing to see if they need to evaluate it for the other cannabinoids.
Wow. That's a really important point that you made. And I kind of asked you before, as far as potency is another thing. You're making the point, it's like, okay, there's Delta, you know, THC-9 in like Ben Spacer's case, but did they or did they not? We don't know. We haven't, just like you said, test for all these other cannabinoids that can play a huge role. But is there a way of doing potency? Like if you go to a dispensary, you could buy dabs and shatters that are 90% THC versus a joint that may have 25% THC. And forensically, after the fact, can you tell the difference? Can you say, oh, that bong, that's wax, that's the 90% kind versus like the same chemical versus, oh, that's the weaker kind?
Yeah. At the end of the day, no. When you're testing, when you're testing somebody's biological fluid, you don't know how they consumed that, you know, because even if they have really high concentrations of Delta-9 or its metabolite in their body, mm-hmm. you don't know if they consumed a highly potent product or they just consumed over hours and hours and hours a low potency product. It's impossible to tell.
You can't tell. That's what I figured. You talked about product and quality control and how you like you know the package may look beautiful, and then you test it, and not only does it have different chemicals that are not natural, there's hairs and debris and fungus and other things. Is there a way, like if you go to you're in Virginia, is marijuana legal in Virginia?
In Virginia, we have medical marijuana that has a regulated program, right, which is quality assurance testing done with it. And then in Virginia, we have adult use, meaning that you can grow up to 4 plants at your home. We do not have an adult use retail marketplace in Virginia.
So if you go to one of these legal places, Can you count on that not having hair and fungus and that what's on the label is really what you're buying or not?
No, there's no. The consumers have no idea. In the unregulated marketplace.
But in what's called a medical, like it, can you count on that? Like only go to this store, don't go to that store.
Yeah. So, you know, that's, I think, another confusing place for the consumers. So in our regulated marketplace, our medical marijuana marketplace, and this is the, I would say, the case across the board, in a state's regulated program, those products have to be quality assurance tested. They have to be produced in clean facilities so that consumers can have some assurance that the products that they're buying are clean, high quality, not contaminated. Now, of course, there have been cases around the country where, you know, that's maybe not the case. You know, because the regulated system is still maturing. But for the most part, if a consumer wants to ensure that they are consuming a clean product, they need to go to a store that is regulated. And so in Virginia, for instance, the reason why that's complicated is that people don't understand what that difference is. So in Virginia, you have what's called a dispensary. The dispensary is in the regulated program. But when consumers go to a vape shop and, you know, and half of the vape shop are all cannabis products, they believe that they're walking into a dispensary where all of the products are quality tested and they can have some confidence in that. So consumers really still don't understand what the difference is between the regulated and unregulated products and marketplace.
But if you had a smart consumer and they looked up, you know, and licensed regulated medical marijuana shop, if you go there, can you be confident that you won't get aspergillus?
Yeah. So if you have, if a consumer has in Virginia, it has a medical certification, and they walk into a state-sanctioned dispensary, then they are going to be able to purchase products that have been quality tested to make sure that they don't contain, you know, fungus and bacteria, and the potency is correct on the label, and there's no pesticides, there's no heavy metals, et cetera, et cetera.
And do you believe that? Because there was one study in California of 20 legal dispensaries, and they tested product from all 20, and 100% of the flower product had E. coli, aspergillus, and various, there was no escaping it. And then when I talked to, I don't know if you know, Dr. Mahmoud El-Soli, who who grows marijuana for NIDA and for testing, he really has to spend a lot of time sterilizing, sanitizing, and making sure that the product doesn't have these contaminants. And when I asked him, is there any place in the country that does what you do? And he said, no.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is the unfortunate part of this story, is that the state oversight of regulated programs has challenges. And there's certainly, unfortunately, a lot of evidence, even in regulated marketplaces, that they do have pesticides in them and they do have bacteria and fungus in them. And so that really demonstrates that the laboratories have to, in some way, I don't know what the answer is, in some way not have to be beholden to their customers, right? To the cannabis industry who's making the products. And so it really is incumbent upon the labs to make sure that they have created a safe environment for the laboratories to have high quality in what the laboratories do, but also have the freedom and the ability to say this product is contaminated and not push it out. So it is true that there are problems on both sides of the fence in the regulated versus non-regulated marketplace. But I would say that at the end of the day, for consumers, if you're going to choose to purchase a product and walk into a store to buy that product, you're probably better off doing that in the in a regulated store, in a regulated dispensary, under a regulated program that requires the quality assurance testing.
Yeah, that makes sense. Clinically, as a physician, though, when I get, you know, in most cases, if it has a little contaminants and you're a young, healthy person, it's fine. But if you're a cancer patient and you're immunocompromised and people say, well, I want to take something natural for my breast cancer pain. I don't want to take those dangerous opioids. I say, take those opioids because, you know, if you're first of all, smoking anything's not healthy for you, no matter what. But even if you're doing the edibles, if there's a risk of those contaminations and you're immunocompromised, that's a big deal. And even the CDC has an alert that most people don't know about of not to use the smoked products if you're immunocompromised.
I completely understand the challenge with that in terms of, you know, patients wanting to have access to something and, you know, if they're immunocompromised and they want to use cannabis and you're still in this place of, I don't know where to send you, to assure to make sure that you get a clean product. Yeah. I think that really is, it does go back to the state to say, all right, we have oversight, meaning that we're watching you, right? We have eyeballs on you. We are.
But in most states, the cannabis control oversight is heavy influence from the cannabis industry. So it's the same.
Yeah. It is definitely circular.
What can you teach us about THC and fentanyl combination? Hearing conflicting opinions, recently was a bulletin that came out by an organization that said it's impossible to have a marijuana joint and fentanyl in it because it would burn off the fentanyl and you won't die from it. On the other hand, I'm hearing from parents unverified reports where they insist that their loved one died from marijuana that had fentanyl in it. And unfortunately, there was not that type of testing that you do on the product, just on their loved one who died. And I've seen in the emergency department people who've overdosed on fentanyl, came back with naloxone, and I'll ask them, what did you use? You know, and I'm asking because I want to know if I can offer them treatment if they have a opiate use disorder. And they said, no, it was just marijuana, I swear. All I could think of, maybe there was some residual fentanyl in the bong. What's the science and the forensic about that combination?
I really appreciate that question from this perspective of, you know, me and several of my colleagues have talked around this multiple times, this issue of that there is fentanyl-laced THC. And in thus far, 100% of the cases that we're aware of, not in one instance has it been demonstrated that the THC was laced with fentanyl. Not in one case. So
there have been some... And you're talking about deaths, you're right, because I'm looking for that too. But there have been product, right? There have been several public health alerts, I think Florida and Michigan, where they found marijuana product and there was fentanyl in it, in a drug seizure.
Okay. I'm going to say I'm not aware of those reports.
Okay.
But when me and several of my colleagues came together, we were like, okay, does anybody know of any case in which THC has been found to be laced with fentanyl? And in this cohort of toxicologists that I'm speaking with, we don't know of one case.
Right. And yet there's, I don't know of any either. But I do know those public health alerts. It's not a person who was endangered, but drug seizures, mm-hmm. right? Where they but again, it's not universal. It's just they look, one seizure of this, you know, marijuana that was found to have fentanyl in it. So that, I mean, we do have that. That's like case reports, but I don't know anybody. But I think it's because we don't test also, right? Somebody died. They insist it was, you know, there's, you know, maybe marijuana things on the scene. The medical examiner checks the decedent and it's positive for fentanyl, xylazine, and marijuana. But nobody tested that marijuana plant, the non-biological parts, to see if that is true, if that marijuana had anything in it. So I feel like we're not checking, that we haven't proved the negative yet, right? We haven't found any cases, but for these cases where there is an allegation, we haven't like closed the loop to say, no, we checked, it's not that.
I mean, that might be the case. I'll be honest. I'm definitely going to reach out to some colleagues of mine in Florida about that seizure to see if that's actually the case and what was actually found. You know, so that if there is THC laced fentanyl, then we can talk about this from an informed perspective. But what we do know is that. You know, because we're not good at closing that loop, so to speak, in terms of can we get a hold of the source material so that we can actually see was it laced, or do we have a situation where somebody is consuming two or three different products in a short span of each other, and then in the biological tissue we see all of them together, so you don't know if they took them all from the same product or they had that across two or three products. So it is complicated, right? When you're talking about these kinds of issues, getting the source material is absolutely critical. And there have to be collaborations between the toxicologist, the controlled substances section in a crime lab, law enforcement, attorney general's offices, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody who is a stakeholder in that overdose situation, whether it led to a death or not, that you have to wait on the science, you have to wait on the laboratory, you've got to get controlled substances section that works with the plant material or the product or the powder or whatever, and you got to get the toxicologist, you got to get all of that together first before an announcement is put out that, oh my goodness, this product was bought from this shop and it was laced with fentanyl.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Right. So it really Absolutely. Does call for, before alerts get sent out and before they get issued, that you wait for the scientists to come together and somebody, if those units aren't all working together, somebody forces that hand to get all of those teams working together so that they can get to the bottom of it. You know, because that's you don't just want to send out a bad message, but you yeah. want to make sure that right. people so, like, are safe.
I had a patient, like my other shift, who overdosed, and it was a very bad overdose. He was found unconscious on a bus, and he required, I don't know, 8 doses of naloxone. And then we finally just admitted him on a naloxone drip because he kept going down. And when he was awake, I'd ask him, like, what did you take? No, I only took a vape pen. Where's your vape pen? He showed me the vape pen. And I said, no, you know, really, I mean, it, like, you're almost died from something. And he's like, no, only marijuana. His drug screen, and then my toxicology is not at all as fancy as yours, but his drug screen was positive only for fentanyl, no THC. And the vape pen, I'm thinking, you know, like, oh my God, maybe this, I found the one case. And I called my friends in law enforcement because I can't test product, but they came by as a favor and tested the vape pen. It was not fentanyl. So I was thinking, you know, this dramatic public health alert, but it didn't. It's just like what you said, it's false. Is it even, if somebody had a bong, this was a vape pen, but if somebody had a bomb, I'm thinking my other patient, and they thought they're smoking marijuana and there's fentanyl residue from somebody else.
Sure.
Can you overdose from that?
Yeah, I would say the answer is yes, right? Yeah. I mean, if there's residue from in there and somebody is consuming fentanyl who's naive to fentanyl, right? So you've got somebody who just, prefers to consume cannabis. And they're fentanyl naive, they're opioid naive, and now they are consuming their cannabis from a product that has fentanyl residue in it. But yeah, that's dangerous for sure.
Yeah. And what about the theory that if the fentanyl was in the marijuana, when you smoke it, the heat is so high that it degrades the fentanyl molecule. Is that true? I heard that was the initial theory. And then I heard from some people from DEA that's false. That's not correct.
Yeah, I would side with the DEA on that.
Yeah, it is possible.
I would say that I'm just going to say that I don't know. It's right. I mean, I'd have to sit down.
But you wouldn't put out an alert saying this is impossible. You could smoke pot. And even if it had fentanyl in it, you're not going to die. That doesn't happen.
That you're not going to die from smoking fentanyl?
A marijuana joint that may have fentanyl in it, because it'll just burn and kill the fentanyl.
I'm not going to say either way. Right. I mean, I'm going to have to sit down with a book and figure out, right? Well, what is the flashpoint?
And that's the point, right? Is that you're sitting down with a book, not in real life. You don't take that.
Yeah.
That chance with a human life, right? Even if you did, in theory, on a Petri dish, find that this is true, or not a Petri dish, but that
it's true.
Graduated cylinder. That you wouldn't make a health advisory based on that. That I think that's dangerous. Anyway, yeah. That's a good discussion. Thank you. I'm going to find those cases and send it to you.
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
Yeah. CBD, legal, buy it on Amazon, get my nails done. They sell it over there. And yet we've seen public health alerts on heavy metals and poisons and things from multiple CBD products. How does a consumer know, like, if it's a good CBD product or a contaminated one, and if what's on the label is real or not?
They can't, unless the only assurance that somebody is consuming a CBD product that is safe, the closest they're going to get to having some assurance is if it's bought under a regulated marketplace. And we've just discussed that even the regulated marketplaces has significant challenges. So if they are purchasing CBD in an unregulated capacity, you don't know. And I'll be honest, even if you're purchasing from major stores, we have some evidence that even the major stores have CBD products that aren't exactly what the label says they are. So there are challenges in that CBD marketplace, right? Because for the most part, they are unregulated and consumers don't know the difference, right? Now, I would say if you are going to consume a CBD product, and you're not purchasing in the regulated space, go to a name brand store. Because they might be making safer choices with those CBD products. But when you put a CBD product that is purchased from a small, storefront out in the country, and you stack that product next to something that gets purchased in a major box store, consumers believe that both of those products are safe to take because they have some belief that they wouldn't be on the shelf unless they were quality tested or safe. So consumers don't understand. They don't understand what that difference is.
Right.
And so
even for things in, like, not THC and CBD, right? If I go to the store and I need vitamin D because I have vitamin D deficiency, I make sure that even if I'm going to CVS or Walgreens, that it has a USP seal. And I know that it really has the 5,000 international units of vitamin D. Otherwise, I really don't, even at, you know, big store chains, I don't know what I'm buying, even for vitamins, without that seal. And there's no such thing like of that with the cannabinoid products.
Yeah, there's not. And, you know, and so, you know, people don't understand to look for that. I mean, you can even go to a certain store that is known to sell vitamins and powders that help with muscle building and right. And it's been demonstrated time and again that those powders that are meant to help people build muscle have been adulterated with drugs. So, right. So, I mean, yeah. Again, consumers don't know.
Yeah. So what's your advice? You're an advisor also to various regulatory agencies, including the Drug Testing Advisory Board at SAMHSA. What is your advice to these decision makers?
So, well, it depends on who the decision maker is the first thing. Mm-hmm. If it is, you know, somebody that is just generally doing drug testing, you know, it's, I think, and we're talking about fit for purpose in terms of can that person do that function at that time of that day? You know, then I think at the 50,000 foot level, we have to reevaluate what we mean by impairment and fit for duty. And is there a better tool for us to determine whether somebody is capable of doing that job that day at that moment? So I think generally speaking, as a research scientist, that we have to find a better measure to determine somebody's ability to do a job. I think to let's say at state levels, in terms of all of these products in the marketplace, I think that there have to be stronger legislation, and there has to be better regulatory oversight of products. Right. So you have to write clearer legislation potentially to ban all of these semi-synthetics. And you have to make sure that if you've banned them, then have you given your law enforcement tools and education to say, okay, I can go into that store and I'm able to, if they're selling it, I'm going to pull this, this, and this product. That is complicated, right? We're putting a tremendous burden on law enforcement that is already, you know, overburdened. But I do think that regulatory bodies can serve in that capacity to make sure that products that are on shelves follow A, the legislative authority, and B, whatever regulations get set in terms of what can be sold in the marketplace for consumers. So, right. So you've got layers of oversight that needs to happen there. And that's a challenge, right? Because when you go into, let's say, even legislative bodies that are making decisions about what the legislation should be, you know, there are some very powerful and savvy lobbyists that are there from the industry that have sway. And so it really is incumbent upon scientists and people in the know to come and testify alongside those lobbyists so that we get the right legislation in place to protect health and safety. For advice to folks who are doing drug testing, like right here in the heat of the moment, I understand the complicated landscape they have, right? Because some of the challenge, for instance, in the regulated drug testing space is that that drug list is actually pretty short. And it's meant to drive to like the major drugs that people consume. And at one point it was very, very difficult to change that list because of the way it was organized in the Federal Register. But I believe now that they have been able to pull that drug list out separate so that they can be more nimble at expanding that drug testing list as they need to. So we might actually see the federal list expand pretty significantly. My advice to them would be to do so, right, into the drugs that are we find that are more commonplace in the market now. It's difficult, though, across the board, particularly when, you know, culturally we are seeing this narrative that, you know, people consume cannabis, you know, for multiple reasons. And there's this growing acceptance of that. So I think culturally we're just in such a difficult place between, you know, what do we do to keep the public safe, whether that is in a safety sensitive position and keeping impaired people off of our roadways, keep them from driving, in making sure that in this current climate that consumers have products that are safe to consume. I think there's always going to be a marketplace for illicit use, right? So whatever, I mean, there's just going to be consumers that want to consume things that we know are just dangerous.
Yeah, and they know too.
And they know too. And so I don't know that there's necessarily a better way to manage that other than through, you know, substance use treatment and prevention programs, right? Yeah. Of what kind of decisions are you making with your life? I just think we're just in such a hard landscape now. And I understand the difficulties of our regulatory bodies. In terms of like, if your goal is to protect public health and public safety, that they're going to have to make some very unpopular decisions. You know, when that is your goal, you just have to shoulder it. And that's a hard message, right? Because we know that if you give people a little bit of room to do something, that will get abused, right? That space, that freedom is going to be taken for granted, expanded, and people will get hurt. And so, all right, so how do you put up some guardrails?
Yeah, interesting. And you wouldn't advise employers, their job is not public safety or public health. They just need to get, you know, their product driven from one place to the other, or, you know, people to work in their restaurant and maybe,
yeah.
You know, should they eliminate drug testing, or what some have done, just eliminate the marijuana part of the drug testing?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a great discussion to have, you know, because our challenge is, all right, if that's not a public health conversation, that is an economic engine conversation, because the amount of work that is lost to people consuming substances, whether that's alcohol or THC or fentanyl, the amount of work that is lost across the board is, you know, in the hundreds of millions of dollars of lost work capacity, lost productivity, mistakes made. And that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with people getting hurt in the workplace because of substance use. That's just lost productivity. So, right. So I think companies who have to keep an eye to their bottom line they have to make some hard decisions about drug testing that might also be unpopular.
Yeah.
So it takes us back to this place of how do we assess impairment at the time of duty?
Right. And it was intriguing to have a conversation with somebody who is an administrator of a hospital. And they said, this is an open book test. Like, we know, like, in 1 month on a Tuesday, you're going to come in and have this test. So it's an open book test, and yet people still fail. And the solution was like, okay, we're just going to get rid of the testing. I'm thinking, you know, what a liability if that, when a mistake happens or something, a bad outcome happens, and that was the policy. Okay, and I don't think people want their doctors and nurses to have, impairment when they're receiving medical care.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I agree with that. But, and I'm not saying get rid of drug testing. I'm definitely not saying that because I do.
It's a deterrence.
Right. I do understand that value. But when you're using that to make decisions about, and let's say it's, random drug testing. Mm-hmm. And again, I appreciate using that for a deterrence measure. But, if you have somebody report in a random drug test and let's say, they're positive for Delta-9 THC metabolite, right? It indicated that they consumed THC anywhere from 3 to 7 days ago. Does that mean that they are impaired at the moment?
Maybe not.
Right. So, I think, again, it's I'm not saying to eliminate drug testing, but, we have to be thoughtful about what question are we asking and what are we going to do with an answer when we get it?
Yeah. Dr. Michelle Peace, thank you so much. We learned so much from you. So wonderful. I think I'm going to continue a dialogue with you even after this podcast because of all the wealth of knowledge. And thank you for teaching us, sharing with us, and your time.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity, and I do look forward to future conversations.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more high truths.